Let me welcome you formally to this session on Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story, Young Goodman Brown. I'm Luther Lidke, your presenter and discussion leader. Our session is going to be divided into two parts this morning. I'll be playing a taped dramatic reading of Young Goodman Brown, which will last for about 25 minutes in all. And following that, we'll have discussion then of the themes and the symbolism and the application of Hawthorne's story. Before I begin, though, I should take a few minutes, I think, to make some introductory comments on American literature, Nathaniel Hawthorne in particular, in order to set this story in a context. Critics and historians have often commented on the peculiarly psychological and spiritual qualities of writing in America, particularly those works which make up classical American literature. British and European poets and novelists, with some tremendous exceptions, of course, have tended to emphasize social realism in their writings and have concentrated on man in his various social relationships. The themes that you'd expect to find in novels by Dickens, for example, or Thackeray or George Eliot will be concerned with marriage, with courtship, with the proper placement of one's sons professionally and one's daughters by marriage, with protecting property, with communicating family property from one generation to another, which are very middle-class bourgeois concerns, which affect all of us, of course. We're to describe British writing graphically, it might look something like this. Here is the large world of social concerns, and novels from Britain and Europe will be populated with large numbers of people linked together in various ways, and these linkages make the plots and the subplots of the novels. This is less true for poetry, of course, but European writing is characterized by main plots and main subplots, which involve large numbers of characters together in defining their social relationships vis-a-vis one another. American writers, from the very beginning, however, have tended to de-emphasize this wide range, middle range of social relationships, and have concentrated on two other areas. American writers have tended to deal introspectively, to concentrate on the motivations and the moral accountability of individual people as they search their own souls, as they study their motives, as they look at the moral implications of their actions. And American authors have also tended to perform transcendentally in their writings, to look beyond society to the maker of all things and to the evidences of that maker which can be found in nature. In other words, to look at nature symbolically in order better to understand the face of God. If we were to perform a similar kind of graphing for American literature, let's label this as British European writing. Over here, American writing. We would have some such structure as this. God, nature, and man. Really, with this kind of hierarchy also, as man as the lowest of all forms. And American literature then is typically concerned with the relationships between these three elements. Man, as he looks at himself psychologically and introspectively, man, as he observes nature around him, as he looks for natural signs of divinity, as he looks for natural signs of a creative order, and then perhaps also man as he directly beholds the face of God. Whereas European writing tends to give us men and women, of course, in a corporate sense, American literature tends to introduce man in an individual sense, as a single, solitary soul, striving to define his status, his place, his character, his position in the greater order of things. It would be hard-pressed, particularly until well into the 20th century, to find works of American literature in which the individual, single human being is not central, and in which he strives to define what it means to be a man, what it means to be an individual, what it means to be an American, by looking at nature, by looking directly perhaps to God, or by analyzing his own motives and instincts. I don't know how well acquainted most of you are with works of American literature, but I suspect that almost all of us at one time or another have read a novel by James Fenimore Cooper with Natty Bumppo or Leatherstocking or Deerslayer or Pathfinder as the central character. This is certainly true for him, a single, solitary man on the frontier between civilization and wilderness, between himself and God, striving to find his place. This would certainly also be true for Ahab, the demonic sea captain of Herman Melville's novel. It's true for Huckleberry Finn, who's continuously running away from society to be alone and to find his place. It's true in contemporary American writing in such figures as Holden Caulfield of Catcher in the Rye also. All of these characters and creatures who are fleeing from society into an original relationship with nature and God in order to define what it means to be a human being. This psychological and moral quality of American literature has given it a peculiarly questing and philosophical nature, which at many times approaches actual theological debate. This direction in American literature is also allied to a topic that I'm going to address next week called American Civil Religion, which is concerned with the intertwining of religious mission and political destiny in the United States. And both of these subjects, the literary topic that we have today and also the political topic that I'm going to address next week, emerge from the notions that Americans have had from the earliest time that our national departure from the complex and tyrannous society of Europe and our occupation of this new open spacious realm of America has also made it possible for man in the United States to expect a new revelation of the face of God, to see directly nature and through nature the face of God without the interruption and the distractions of church hierarchies, of court systems, of complex urban settings. Nowhere is the spiritual and psychological quality of American writing more apparent or revealed more dramatically than in the novels and short stories of Nathaniel Hawthorne. I suspect that most of us at one time or another have read at least The Scarlet Letter, perhaps also The House of the Seven Gables, maybe The Marble Faun, which are Hawthorne's best-known novels. Nathaniel Hawthorne was born in 1804 in Salem, Massachusetts, in the seventh generation of a Puritan New England family of Hawthorne's, who counted among their numbers several famous Puritan ministers and also a large number of sea captains. Hawthorne's own father was a sea captain who was lost on a return voyage from Suriname when Hawthorne himself was only 4 years old. And the half-orphanhood of Hawthorne is, I think, important also to our discussion of young Goodman Brown. One of Hawthorne's intolerant ancestors had some infamy for whipping a heretical Quaker woman through the streets of Salem in 1642. The woman had been stripped to the waist to increase her shame and embarrassment. And that kind of intolerance was one of the subjects that Hawthorne himself brooded upon. His ancestors was a member of the, or was one of the judges in the Salem witchcraft trials of the 1690s. This is all in Hawthorne's lineage. Following his graduation from Bowdoin College in 1825, Nathaniel Hawthorne returned to Salem and went into a 12-year seclusion, lasting until 1837, when he was happily married and redeemed from his solitude by a very bright and spiritual young woman named Sophia Peabody. During these 12 years, though, of seclusion, Hawthorne brooded over his family and cultural parentage, over what he had inherited from the past. He struggled mightily with his own powerful sexuality and carried out a theological quarrel with God also. Out of the furnace of this period came his best-known stories and his novels, which he once termed hellfire tales. And one of the finest of these is Young Goodman Brown. From this period and from the powerful example of Hawthorne has also come a strong tradition in American literature, a tradition of anguished psychological and spiritual searching, which includes such other writers as Herman Melville, the late works of Mark Twain, Henry James, Robert Frost, William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, by whom I'll have a story next week, and Robert Penn Warren. Some of you may have been here earlier this week when Will Campbell's Brother to a Dragonfly was mentioned. I think it was mentioned at one of the settings at lunch. Campbell's Brother to Dragonflies itself is a spin-off of, or an answer to, Robert Penn Warren's long poem called Brothers to Dragons, which is powerfully influenced by Hawthorne. So we have a lineage even flowing into the work of Holden Village. I'm going to play now the dramatic reading of Young Goodman Brown. And while you're listening to it, I'd encourage you to store up questions and observations that you'd like to make, because the last half of our session together is going to be discussion rather than a structured presentation by me.
Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the street at Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife. And Faith, and the wife was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap, while she called to Goodman Brown.
Dearest heart, prithee put off your journey until sunrise, and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year.
My love and my faith, of all nights in the year, this one night must I tarry away from thee. My journey, as thou callest it, forth and back again, must needs be done twixt now and sunrise. What, my sweet, pretty wife, dost thou doubt me already, and we but 3 months married?
Then God bless you, and may you find all well when you come back.
Amen. Say thy prayers, dear Faith, and go to bed at dusk, and no harm will come to thee.
So they parted. And the young man pursued his way until, being about to turn the corner by the meeting house, he looked back and saw the head of Faith still peeping after him with a melancholy air, in spite of her pink ribbons.
Poor little Faith. What a wretch am I to leave her on such an errand. She talks of dreams, too. Methought as she spoke there was trouble in her face, as if a dream had warned her what work is to be done tonight. Well, she's a blessed angel on earth, and after this one night, I'll cling to her skirts and follow her to heaven.
With this excellent resolve for the future, Goodman Brown felt himself justified in making more haste on his present evil purpose. He had taken a dreary road, darkened by all the gloomiest trees of the forest, which barely stood aside to let the narrow path creep through, and closed immediately behind. It was all as lonely as could be.
There may be a devilish Indian behind every tree. Oh, what if the devil himself should be at my very elbow?
As he passed a crook of the road, he beheld the figure of a man in grave and decent attire, seated at the foot of an old tree. The man arose at Goodman Brown's approach and walked onward side by side with him.
You are late, Goodman Brown. The clock of the old South Church was striking as I came through Boston, and that is 4:15 agone.
Faith kept me back a while.
It was now deep dusk in the forest, and deepest in that part of it where these two were journeying. The second traveller was about 50 years old and bore a considerable resemblance to Goodman Brown. The two might have been taken for father and son. The older man carried a remarkable staff which looked like a great black snake, so curiously wrought that it might almost seem to twist and wriggle itself like a living serpent. This, of course, must have been a visual deception, assisted by the uncertain light.
Come, Goodman Brown, this is a dull pace for the beginning of a journey. Take my staff, if you are so soon weary.
Friend, having kept covenant by meeting thee here, it is my purpose now to return whence I came.
Sayest thou so? Let us walk on, nevertheless, reasoning as we go. And if I convince thee not, thou shalt turn back. We are but a little way in the forest yet.
Oh, too far, too far. My father never went into the woods on such an errand, nor his father before him. We have been a race of honest men and good Christians since the days of the martyrs. And shall I be the first of the name of Brown that ever took this path and kept...
And kept such company, thou wouldst say... Well said, Goodman Brown, but I have been as well acquainted with your family as with ever a one among the Puritans, and that's no trifle to say.
That could not be.
I helped your grandfather, the constable, when he lashed the Quaker woman so smartly through the streets of Salem.
Oh.
And it was I that brought your father a pitch pine knot to set fire to an Indian village.
Oh.
They were my good friends, both. And many a pleasant walk have we had along this path, and returned merrily after midnight.
I marvel that they never spoke of these matters. But we are people of prayer, and good works to boot. And abide no such wickedness.
Wickedness or not, I have a very general acquaintance here in New England. The deacons of many a church have drunk the communion wine with me. And a majority of government officials are firm supporters of my interest. The governor and I, too. But these are state secrets.
Can this be so? Well, I have nothing to do with the governor or governments. Were I to go on with thee, how should I meet the eye of that good old man, our minister at Salem Village?
Go on. Go on, but pray thee, Goodman Brown, don't kill me with laughter.
There is my wife, Faith. It would break her dear little heart, and I'd rather break my own.
Nay, go thy ways, Goodman Brown. I would not for 20 old women like the one hobbling before us. That Faith should come to harm.
As he spoke, he pointed his staff at a female figure on the path, in whom Goodman Brown recognized a very pious and exemplary dame who had taught him his catechism in youth and was still his moral and spiritual adviser.
A marvel, truly, that Goody Cloy should be so far into the wilderness at nightfall. I shall cut through the woods until we've left this Christian woman behind. She might ask whom I was with and whither I was going.
Be it so. Betake you to the woods and let me keep the path.
Young Goodman Brown turned aside, but watched his companion, who advanced softly along the road, until he had come within a staff's length of the old woman. He put forth his staff and touched her withered neck with what seemed the serpent's tail.
Then Goody Cloyes knows her old friend.
Aye, forsooth. And is it your worship indeed? And in the very image of me old friend Goodman Brown, the grandfather of the silly fellow that now is.
Indeed, you have made up your mind to foot it, I see.
Could your worship believe it? Me broomstick hath strangely disappeared, stolen, as I suspect, by that unhanged witch, Goody Cory, when I was all anointed with the juice of smallage and cinquefoin and wolf's bane.
And mingled with fine wheat and the fat of a newborn babe.
Your worship knows the recipe. But now, lend me your arm, and we shall be there in a twinkling. They tell me there is a nice young man to be taken into communion tonight.
I may not spare you my arm, Goody Cloyes, but here is my staff, if you will.
So saying, he threw it down at her feet, where perhaps it assumed life, though Goodman Brown could not be sure. He had cast up his eyes in astonishment, and looking down again, beheld neither Goody Cloyes nor the serpentine star, but his fellow traveller alone, who waited for him as calmly as if nothing had happened.
That old woman taught me my catechism.
They continued to walk onward, until suddenly, in a gloomy hollow of the road, Goodman Brown sat himself down on the stump of a tree and refused to go any farther.
Friend, my mind is made up. Not another step will I budge on this errand. What if a wretched old woman do choose to go to the devil when I thought she was going to heaven? Is that any reason why I should quit my dear faith and go after her?
You will think better of this by and by. Sit here and rest yourself a while until you feel like moving again.
Speedily he vanished into the deepening gloom. The young man sat a few moments by the roadside, applauding himself greatly, and thinking with how clear a conscience he should meet the minister in his morning walk, nor shrink from the eye of good old Deacon Gookin. Just then, Goodman Brown heard voices approaching along the path.
Well, the two, reverend sir, I had rather miss an ordination dinner than tonight's meeting. They tell me that some of our community are to be here from Falmouth and beyond.
And several of the ancient powwows, who after their fashion know almost as much, gentle sir, as the best of us.
Moreover, there's a goodly young woman to be taken into communion.
Mighty well, Deacon Gookin. Spur up, I wish she'll be late. Nothing can be done now until I get on the ground.
Whither could these holy men be journeying so deep into the heathen wilderness?
Young Goodman Brown caught hold of a tree for support, being ready to sink down on the ground, faint and overburdened with the heavy sickness of his heart. He looked up to the sky, doubting whether there really was a heaven above. There was the blue arch, and the stars brightening in it.
With heaven above, and faith below, I will yet stand firm against the devil.
Aloft in the air came a confused and doubtful sound of voices. Once the listener fancied that he could distinguish the accents of townspeople, of his own, men and women both pious and ungodly.
Faith! Faith!
down through the air and caught on the branch of a tree. The young man seized it and beheld a pink ribbon.
Oh, oh, my faith is gone. Oh, there is no good on earth, and sin is but a name. Come, devil, for to thee this world is given.
And maddened with despair, so that he laughed loud and long, Goodman Brown again set forth, at such a rate that he seemed to fly along the forest path rather than to walk or run. The road grew wilder and drearier and more faintly traced, and vanished at length, leaving him in the heart of the dark wilderness, still rushing onward with the instinct that guides mortal man to evil. The whole forest was peopled with frightful sounds, the creaking of trees, the howling of wild beasts, and the yell of Indians.
Let us hear which one will laugh loudest. Come, witch! Come, wizard! Come, Indian powwow! Come, devil himself! And here comes Goodman Brown!
On he flew among the black pines, shouting forth such laughter as set all the echoes of the forest laughing like demons around him. The fiend, in his own shape, is less hideous than when he rages in the breast of man. At last, quivering among the trees, young Goodman Brown saw a red light before him, as when the felled trunks and branches of a clearing have been set on fire, and throw up their lurid blaze against the sky at the hour of midnight.
I know the tune. It is a familiar one, in the choir of the village meeting house.
At one extremity of an open space, hemmed in by the dark wall of the forest, arose a rock, bearing some rude, natural resemblance either to an altar or a pulpit, and surrounded by four blazing pines, their tops aflame. As the red light arose and fell, a numerous congregation alternately shone forth, then disappeared in shadow, and again grew out of the darkness, peopling the heart of the solitary woods at once.
Grave and dark-clad company, but where is Faith?
There were a great multitude, ancient dames and fair young girls, who trembled lest their mothers should see them. Either the sudden gleams of light flashing over the obscure field bedazzled Goodman Brown, or he recognized a score of the church members of Salem Village. Good old Deacon Gookin had arrived and waited upon that venerable saint, his reverend pastor. Before the base of the great stone pulpit appeared a dark figure.
Bring forth the converts.
At the word, Goodman Brown stepped forth from the shadow of the trees and approached the congregation, with whom he felt a loathful brotherhood by the sympathy of all that was wicked in his heart. Also came forth the slender form of a veiled girl, led between Goody Cloys, that pious teacher of the catechism, and Martha Carrier, who had received the devil's promise to be queen of hell.
Welcome, my children, to the communion of your race. You have found thus young your nature and your destiny. My children, look behind you.
They turned, and flashing forth, as it were, in a sheet of flame, the fiend worshippers were seen. The smile of welcome gleamed darkly on every face.
Here are all whom ye have reverenced from youth. This night it shall be granted you to know their secret deeds. By the sympathy of your human hearts for sin, ye shall scent out all the places where crime has been committed, and shall exult to behold the whole earth one stain of guilt, one mighty blood spot. Oh, my children, look upon each other.
They did so, and by the blaze of the hell-kindled torches, the wretched man beheld his face, and the wife, her husband, trembling before that unhallowed altar.
Lo, here ye stand, my children, depending upon one another's hearts. Ye had still hoped that virtue was not all a dream. Now are ye undeceived. Evil is the nature of mankind. Evil must be your only happiness. Welcome again, my children, to the communion of your race.
And there they stood, the only pair, as it seemed, who were yet hesitating on the verge of wickedness in this dark world. A basin was hollowed naturally in a rock. Did it contain water, reddened by the lurid light? Or was it blood? Or perhaps a liquid flame? Herein did the shape of evil dip his hand and prepare to lay the mark of baptism upon their foreheads, that they might be partakers of the mystery of sin. What polluted wretches would the next glance show them to each other, shuddering alike at what they saw?
Faith! Faith! Look up to heaven and resist the wicked one!
Whether Faith obeyed, he knew not. Hardly had he spoken when he found himself amid calm night and solitude, listening to a roar of the wind which died heavily away through the forest. He staggered against the rock and felt it chill and damp. The next morning, young Goodman Brown came slowly into the street of Salem Village, staring around him like a bewildered man. The good old minister was taking a walk along the graveyard to get an appetite for breakfast and to meditate his sermon. He bestowed a blessing as he passed on Goodman Brown, who shrank from the venerable saint as if to avoid a curse. Through an open window came the words of prayer from old Deacon Gookin.
What god doth the wizard pray to?
Goody Cloyes, that excellent old Christian, stood in the early sunshine at her gate, teaching a little girl who had brought her a pint of morning milk. Goodman Brown snatched away the child as from the grasp of the fiend himself. Turning the corner by the meeting house, he spied the head of Faith, with the pink ribbons, gazing anxiously forth and bursting into such joy at sight of him that she skipped along the street and almost kissed her husband before the whole village. But Goodman Brown looked sternly and sadly into her face and passed on without a greeting. Had Goodman Brown fallen asleep in the forest and only dreamed the wild dream of a witch meeting? Be it so, if you will. But alas, it was a dream of evil omen for young Goodman Brown. A stern, a sad, a darkly meditative, a distrustful, if not a desperate man did he become from the night of that fearful dream. On the Sabbath day, when the congregation was singing a holy psalm, he could not listen
because an anthem of sin rushed loudly upon his ear and drowned all the blessed strain. When the minister spoke from the pulpit with power and fervid eloquence, and with his hand on the open Bible of the sacred truths of our religion and of saint-like lives and triumphant deaths and of future bliss or misery unutterable, then did Goodman Brown turn pale, dreading lest the roof should thunder down upon the grey blasphemer and his hearers. Often, awaking suddenly at midnight, he shrank from the bosom of faith. And at morning, or eventide, when the family knelt down at prayer, he scowled and muttered to himself and gazed sternly at his wife and turned away. And when he had lived long and was borne to his grave, a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, a goodly procession, besides neighbors not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom.
No hopeful words were carved on his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom. How many of you had read this story before at some point?
Yeah,
a couple read it last night. And maybe you could lead us off with some questions or some comments. Unless, first of all, there is some uncertainty about what happened. I realize the quality of the tape was not all the best. And also that it is a complicated story. If you have any questions about point A, B, C, D, E, F, G in the story and so forth, maybe I could clear those up first, and that could be a basis then for our discussion. That's a very good question, and there are many dimensions to it also. First of all, you might say that Hawthorne himself was no Orthodox believer. He was not a churchman. He was skeptical about fundamental tenets of the congregational faith as it had come to him through his family. And what we get in Hawthorne's novels and his short stories is more the psychological and the cultural dimension of the inherited religion than a set of tenets or theological principles. And in this story there is this dramatic struggle between the forces of light and between the forces of darkness, whether we regard them as satanic and divine or in other terms is uncertain. But it's all brought to bear upon the individual, young Goodman Brown here. Incidentally, Goodman and Goodwoman were titles like Mr. and Mrs. at the time. They are not evaluative. There wouldn't have been an opposite of Bad Man Brown or Bad Woman Brown. It was just a way of reading and naming people at the time. The amount of biographical detail which Hawthorne is putting into this himself, the Quaker scourging minister, for example, and the ancestor who burned out the Indian village, I think helps point up the nearness of this character, young Goodman Brown, to Hawthorne. And the fact that the young woman, Faith, appears here as initially a redemptive force on the young man also is quite close to what Hawthorne felt he had gotten out of his own marriage to Sophia Peabody. By the time he married, he was, I think, about 38 years old. And he was a character very much in turmoil with himself, and he married a pious, artistic, and very ethereal young woman whom he felt saved him from his own worst impulses. So there is a good deal of his individual psychology going into this story. Now, that doesn't answer your question about the satirical nature of this. I think it is ironic. I'm not sure that satirical satire tends to belittle or to dismiss something else. We use satire as a way of claiming our superiority, usually, over whatever it is that's being satirized. Irony, on the other hand, does not have that same function. I think we could listen to this story or read the story as Hawthorne's criticism of the worst impulses of Puritanism. In other words, that the Puritans were so perhaps trapped in their own gloom and their desire to find sin in others, that there was no room for joy, for grace, for forgiveness within their own lives.
Mm-hmm. I had read this story before, and the same sentence strikes me that where the devil says, you'll find that in sin your only pleasure, your only joy, it seems that maybe Hawthorne, this is another thing, I'm not too sure whether he meant this consciously or it was something that came through unconsciously, but there has been such a dichotomy between the good and the bad parts of human beings for so long through Puritanism, that in a way perhaps he was longing for sin or for the acceptance of the entire humanity of us to be our pleasure, that it was portrayed as the devil's domain in this story, but perhaps it was something that Hawthorne himself really longed for, to have that part of people accepted enough, all the nastiness, mm-hmm. but that rather than individual sins, that he was saying, in sin, all of our humanity is encompassed as well.
There's a historical problem in defining exactly what Puritanism was like, psychologically and socially, and contemporary scholars tend to find much more joy and forgiveness and celebration, even in the passionate side of man's life in Puritan times, than is communicated through Hawthorne. And Hawthorne probably has had more to do with the gloomy, dark, black image of Puritanism that people share than the actual historical experience. But your point's well made. Anyhow, I think it leads to another question of who is the greater sinner in Young Goodman Brown. Young Goodman Brown leaves his village in the evening, bids farewell to Faith, moves into the forest, into the wilderness, where he finds an increasingly narrow and twisted path, and encounters a number of people along the way who are all from the village. The woman who has taught him his catechism, the deacon, eventually the minister he finds along the way, and the devil appears to him in the image of his own father and of his grandfather. And he's then eventually led to this witch's Sabbath, where there is a satanic communion, and the words baptism, communion, covenant run very bluntly throughout, and at the end finds that Faith, whom he had thought to leave behind him, has accompanied him, and that she now is also about to receive the baptism. He calls to her to look up to heaven, and then the whole thing evaporates, disappears, and he finds himself alone in the forest. Now, it would seem on the face of this that he has saved himself at the last moment by appealing to heaven, and that he hasn't finally drunk of this cup of knowledge of good and evil. And Hawthorne throws in one of his usual ambiguities also and asks, was this all a dream, or did it really happen? And Young Goodman Brown then comes back to the city, or in the village, and finds the people there as they were the day before, teaching the catechism, patting children on the head, the wife faithfully waiting for him. And he is the one who is gloomy and unforgiving for the rest of his life. Well, who is the greater sinner in this? Is it Young Goodman Brown? Is it the deacon, the good woman, Faith herself?
I saw it as Goodman Brown.
Oh, is that?
When he went into the forest, he lost his faith. And when he came back, all he could see was sin in others.
Do you think Hawthorne is trying to show us that even the people who are supposed to be with God are some of the greatest sinners? That it isn't just the lowly people in the congregation. Well, of course, that was brought out in the Scarlet Letter. But so many. It is the people that we look up to who are leading us to Christ, who they themselves are the deepest sinners.
That's one half of the story, I think, and in chronological order is probably the half that we come to first.
Mm-hmm.
And as the story deepens, I think we get a sense that, yes, this is original sin, which is being unmasked, that beneath the pious exterior, there are undisclosed, murky, mm-hmm. sin-ridden depths not open to the human eye. But Young Goodman Brown stops at that point. That's the observation that he carries with him through the rest of his life. Mm-hmm.
not sure, but Hawthorne would say that it's pretty much regarded that he was sort of pessimistic, sort of unsure about the things of Puritanism. I think he's struggling with the old idea was that we sort of begrudgingly give up our pleasure and happiness for the earth for something that was supposed to be better, supposed to be better. I think that was kind of the old view of God, be pious, but secretly we want to have fun, that we give up fun, when we do that. And the thing with Satan is saying that this is, this is where fun lies, I kind of see Hawthorne as being sort of on that brink there. Maybe he was searching for that element. Maybe he just didn't buy that, that idea of that.
I don't think there's any question in Hawthorne's psychology of damnation and sin. Of that he was firmly convinced. He had seen enough of it in himself and enough of it in others that his vision is definitely darkened by it. What's more questionable for him is the forgiveness of sin.
He's really searching for grace
in oneself and others. And that finally is what Jan Goodman Brown does not seem to receive. That he takes a kind of arrogance and superiority out of this encounter with evil without and cannot move through it or cannot move beyond it into the acceptance of grace. As if he's traumatized so much by the vision of sin that he cannot still open his arms and welcome others into them once he has had that vision.
It's a hypocrisy of pietism that he saw. And he couldn't see people as a growing thing toward, that he wanted to be perfect. And he couldn't accept the fact that people were growing toward perfection.
The greatest sinners in Hawthorne's novels and in his stories are those who, as he called them, violate the hearts of others, of people who do not keep their distance, but instead are so judgmental that they move into the very core of other people's spirits and stand there to judge and to reject rather than to accept. And part of this, I think, comes through his own personal standoffishness, that it was difficult for him to be close to others, except through a kind of deliberate mental inquiry. And he's putting a lot of himself into Jan Goodman Brown. There's a kind of cathartic experience, I think, for him in setting up this dramatic character and embodying some of the worst aspects of himself as a way of rejecting them, perhaps.
He wrote this shortly after his marriage.
I think this was written about 1838, even though the setting of it is the 1660s.
Yes.
I would have to recheck the dates of composition, but I believe it's about that time when he was undergoing his own liberation, his own discovery. Is there anything else that you've read or seen on television or the big screen that this story reminds you of?
What about Chesapeake? I could see a bit of the Richard in this story.
In what ways? I haven't read Chesapeake.
Oh, well, the woman who was stripped and beautiful sinning by men who were such greater sinners than she ever had thought about being, and the intolerance towards sin and the way that they punish these people. I could, I'm sure he had borrowed it's a takeoff from Hawthorne. You can see the connection there.
That's a historical fact. Hawthorne himself got it from the annals of Salem, which were kept and written during the 17th and 18th century.
But now, of course, this is Maryland down in that area. But it is this.
Some Todd is trying to come in the back door, which is barring. Have any of you yet seen Empire Strikes Back? which is the second part of George Lucas's great Star Wars series, and which gives me a lot of concern. In The Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader, who is the arch villain, the fallen archangel of the Star Wars series, declares himself to be the father of Luke Skywalker, who is the young knight in shining armor, the man in white himself. And Luke Skywalker is having great trouble, and he's going through the next 5 or 6 episodes, all through Star Wars over the next 10 years, in defining his relationship to Darth Vader, and to realize that not only through original sin, but also through inheritance, that the dualism exists within him, the great temptation to achieve the kind of control over others, the satanic ravenous hunger for other souls that Darth Vader has, and which Satan has, to reconcile that with his own desire to do good and to defend everything that's noble and uplifting. And another point at which I most thought of Young Goodman Brown was when seeing a late night television drama a few years ago called Harvest Home.
Oh yeah.
Which is a very sensationalizing thing, and I can't help but believe that it was Triumph who wrote this, Thomas Triumph, had borrowed from Hawthorne. Right up to the Witch's Sabbath, and there's very explicit sexuality also in Harvest Home. Here it's certainly latent. Might take a few more specific points in this story. To begin with, why is Young Goodman Brown's wife named Faith?
Yeah, I
thought
that. He says, that one more.
Pardon?
He says, I left Faith at home.
Yeah, left Faith, yeah. I don't know what he intended. I think he kind of intended for not to listen.
I think he felt that she was what gave him, his wife, Sophia, gave him his faith back again.
And
it was just another name for his wife. I had that feeling.
Yes, and faith is both an abstract quality and a human being here. The name is certainly symbolic. In some of Hawthorne's other writings, he models his allegories after Pilgrim's Progress, for example, and other religious allegories of the kind. And this is an allegorical work in which characters stand for qualities, as well as living out dramatically their own experience. And he does leave his faith behind. This is one time when he is going to walk away into the forest at nightfall to live out a different kind of experience, believing that the next day he can come back unchanged and can reclaim his faith. This faith wears pink ribbons, and we know by the ribbon falling down in front of him just as he approaches the heart of the wilderness that Faith has not stayed at home waiting for him, but that she herself is coming. And the color pink represents the fragility and the delicacy also of his faith. It's not blood red, it's not a complete color, but instead it's weak, and his faith does not hold in this case. Why the forest, and why nighttime? Would this be a different kind of story if he set off at break of day and walked across an open meadow to a pond outside the village?
Right. The beginning of the day, you have the hope and everything. Toward night is when the evil comes in, the bad things crowd around you.
The dark night is meant for sin, symbolism of sin. The dark night is the soul.
Right. That's one of the stages in the mystic process also, to move through the dark night of the soul to the light of morning again.
Well, probably very practically that most people at that time probably didn't do much at night. It was probably guarded at nighttime. It was not for a, very late night vigil. It was not for, a good person, in this more practical sense. That he was sort of delving, just leaving, that behind him, delving into something that maybe normally wouldn't do, just as far as going into the night, into the deep forces that my father would never have done. That's my grandfather never.
That's right. You can't see objects outside. Instead, you're looking inward.
Does he give any clue as to the purpose of his journey? you know, when he talks to Faith, he just doesn't have to go out, you know, all these bad.
I mean, how did this man get him started on the road?
Yeah, why did he want to go out? What was his purpose? Why did he feel he had to go out?
Let me turn that question back to you. There is no explicit answer in the story itself.
Was it something internal then that caused him to do it? I would think it. I mean, it doesn't say that any external person knew what was calling. I would think that he was that it was something within himself that told him that he should take this thing.
Because of sin pulling out.
He had been testing his faith.
The weakest answer would be that there was physically a witch's Sabbath, which he was called to attend in whatever way possible. We very quickly have to go beyond that in this story. And he must do this only once, as he declares it at the beginning.
Well, what is death then?
There is,
faith.
Kind of a reckless passage, you mean?
I think there is a strong sense here that it's something that everybody has to go through at least once. And this is his night. This is his night of testing. This is his night of trial.
This man who was leading him was a good man. And it was customary, like the lady who taught him the catechism, that was the lady he should follow. Well, this man was supposedly a good man. He asked him to do it, so he did.
No, I think he knew what it was.
You think he knew he was
dead? Oh, yeah, I think he knew it. And the thing is, did faith understand? That's, I think it was kind of abstract. I don't think you could say, oh, well, she thought he was going to go do something. I think the whole idea that, you know, what did she think he was going in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was just kind of abstract. I don't really think we could look at it in terms of like, oh, he was going to go
something. Don't you think that's left open for you, yourself, and your own feelings and your own...
That's
you
right.
Feel like, into, and then you become Goodman Brown as he progresses.
That's one of the reasons that this story is so continually evocative also, that it doesn't provide all of the information. It's kind of formula to which we channel our own motivations, our own impulses. The nightfall and darkness have always posed a problem, I think, for Christians. I remember reading some of the instructions in Luther's Small Catechism also about how to go to sleep at night. And one is supposed to say prayers and then instantly go to sleep afterwards. As if something might happen if you stayed awake longer that would take away from the prayers or undercut them. And in the bookstore earlier this week, I picked up a book also on being single, on being unmarried. And there's one section in the book which is devoted to the time between when one goes to sleep or goes to bed and goes to sleep, which is a hazardous period full of all sorts of temptations and dangers. And there are instructions given about how to cross that threshold. Nightfall is archetypal as a time of the coming of dangers, of boogeymen, of spirits, of ghosts, of Satan, or whatever. But in individual terms, it's also a time when our eyes are no longer looking outward and fixing on material objects, but when the mind itself begins to explore. Mm-hmm. And this young Goodman Brown is making more a journey inward than outward.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrow, overgrown pathways that he traverses in the story lie within his own soul and lie within his own mind. They're not just out there in the forest. But for him, they're internal. And it's that kind of exploration that he's going through, visiting the worst instincts within himself, the depth, searching for the lowest depths. But he doesn't rise very far again from those lowest depths after he goes through that.